Welcome to CorpWatch Radio, your weekly review of corporate news. Coming up, our headlines will take us from Norway's divestment from Walmart to mining in Chile, lawsuits against pharmaceutical giant Merck to community groups suing the Environmental Protection Agency. Next, we have an interview with CorpWatch staff writer Sasha Lilly about her recent investigation of agribusiness giant Archer Daniels Midland and their recent push for ethanol. But first, for the week of June 23rd to June 30th, I'm Sakura Saunders.
And I'm Liam O'Donohue.
And these are the headlines.
The government of Norway is using its oil wealth to boycott Walmart. Norway's oil pension fund, the largest in the world, is dropping all of its holdings in Walmart on ethical grounds, accusing the world's largest retailer of committing, quote, serious and systematic violations of human rights and labor rights. The fund's ethics board cited that Walmart pressures employees to work overtime without pay, blocks the formation of unions, discriminates against female employees, violates underage labor laws, and tolerates dangerous working conditions. Walmart has not responded to the action. The fund also dumped its shares in Freeport-McMoRan, a U.S. mining company, citing environmental concerns. A Freeport copper mine in New Guinea is under fire for damaging a natural river ecosystem there. The divestitures from Walmart and Freeport amount to $430 million. Norway's pension fund, which is worth $240 billion, has now divested from 19 companies, including a nuclear weapons manufacturer, for ethical reasons.
According to a new report by Canada's National Energy Board, oil sands production is predicted to triple to 3 million barrels per day by the year 2015. Oil sands, also known as tar sands, are deposits of tar in sandy ground. Unlike crude, it does not flow, and is therefore far more difficult to extract and process into oil. With the prices of oil skyrocketing and war raging in the Middle East, all eyes are on Canada, which boasts the world's second-largest oil reserves. Pioneered in the 1960s by Great Canadian Oil Sands, now Suncor, commercial oil sands mining has been controversial because it requires vast amounts of water and energy to produce a useful end product. Environmentalists are alarmed by the uptick in oil sands mining. To produce a single barrel of oil, the process requires 2 to 5 barrels of water, the excavation of up to 4 tons of earth, and a tremendous amount of natural gas, which contributes to climate change.
Barrick Gold Corporation announced that Chile's National Environmental Commission had given the corporation its final go-ahead on the controversial Pascua-Lama mining project. The ambitious project aims to unearth an estimated 18-million-ounce gold reserve deep within the Pascua-Lama mine, which stretches across the Andes from Argentina into Chile. The announcement came as a major blow to environmentalists and community groups concerned about the mine's potential impact on the environment, public health, and the livelihoods of the 8,000 farmers in the region. In November 2005, a coalition of Chilean groups presented then-President Richard Lagos Escobar with a petition expressing their opposition to the project, signed by some 18,000 community members. While this petition forced Barrick to shelve its plans to relocate 3 glaciers that lay over the mining site, environmental concerns remain, as critics claim that a cozy relationship between the ex-president and Barrick Gold resulted in a skewed environmental impact assessment.
You are listening to CorpWatch Radio. For more information about any of these stories, go to www.corpwatch.org. A bribery scandal involving the Hyundai Motor Company has snared another South Korean government official. Byon Young-ho, former head of the Finance and Economy Ministry's Financial Policy Bureau, was arrested in connection with a corruption scandal involving illegal slush funds. The corruption crackdown has sent shockwaves through the country's financial services community. 6 former government officials and Hyundai executives, including Chairman Chung Mung-koo, have been arrested. Another 10 Hyundai executives have been banned from travel. The scandal has stalled the carmaker's plan for an expansion, including at least one $1.3 billion plant in the Czech Republic. Facing life in prison on embezzlement and breach of trust charges, Hyundai chairman Chung Meng-koo apologized in a Seoul court last week after weeks of denying involvement in the bribery scheme. South Korean courts have handed out mostly lenient rulings to business leaders convicted of graft in recognition of their roles in economic development. This round of convictions follows the imprisonment of Kim Woo-chung, the founder of Daewoo Group, earlier this month. Mr. Kim was sentenced to 10 years in prison and ordered to forfeit $22.57 billion, more than his net worth. These trials have trained attention on the efforts to reform South Korea's powerful chaebol, or family-run corporations. While the rapid growth of these businesses is credited with rebuilding the economy after the Korean War, they were also partly blamed for the economic hardship during the financial crisis of the late 1990s, and now vilified as centers of corruption and fraud.
Pharmaceutical giant Merck finds itself in court once again, defending its controversial Vioxx anti-inflammatory drug, which has been linked to the deaths of more than 60,000 people. The newest lawsuit involves 68-year-old Elaine Doherty, who maintains that her 2004 heart attack was brought on by Vioxx, which has since been pulled from the market. Doherty's case is but one of more than 13,000 Vioxx-related suits, seven of which have already gone to trial, and three of which, all multi-million-dollar suits, Merck has lost. Whistleblower Dr. David Graham, a top FDA researcher and outspoken critic of the FDA's slow response in this matter, has credited corporate influence at the Food and Drug Administration as the primary reason Vioxx remained on the market as long as it did. Graham's accusations have not been well received at the FDA's Drug Evaluation Division. That unit, which determines the safety and efficacy of new drugs, has a $400 million budget, half of it funded by drug companies.
A coalition of national and community-based environmental groups has sued the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to overturn a new rule that they say allows refineries and other industrial plants to emit higher levels of noxious chemicals. The rule, which took effect in April, allows refineries to evade pollution control requirements when starting up, shutting down, or experiencing equipment malfunctions without informing area residents. This lawsuit is in part a response to a power outage last September in Williamton, California, which caused three major oil refineries, owned by Shell, ConocoPhillips, and Valero, to emit toxic black and yellow smoke for over 8 hours. Since the plant's pollution controls were run by electricity, a lack of power made for a lack of controls. Environmental advocates argue that these types of malfunctions could easily be avoided by adopting contingency plans that include a backup power source. But, they argue, the new EPA rule gives refineries license for reckless planning while promoting limited accountability within their local communities. We are joined today by Sasha Lilly, whose recent CorpWatch article, Green Fuel's Dirty Secret, investigates agribusiness giant Archer Daniels Midland's recent push for green energy. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
So, just tell us straight up, is ethanol better for the environment than oil-derived gasoline?
Well, it's complicated because, number one, there's more than one form of ethanol. The ethanol that I focus on in my article is corn-based ethanol, which Archer Daniels Midland is the largest producer of. There's also cellulosic ethanol, and there's a lot of debates about whether that is a more environmentally friendly form of ethanol. But in terms of corn-based ethanol, which is the main form of ethanol that it's producing in this country, really it's very difficult to say whether it makes any significant change for the emissions of greenhouse gases, whether the amount of energy that's used to create ethanol in the first place actually overshadows or is greater than the amount of energy that it produces. And then there are other questions, too, about how that corn-based ethanol is produced.
Okay, so starting just with greenhouse gases, why would ethanol-based fuels produce more or an equivalent amount of greenhouse emissions than oil-based gasoline?
Well, so in the case of Archer Daniels Midland, which is, you know, the focus of this piece, there is a trend that they are epitomizing of ethanol being manufactured using coal to produce it. And so there are many different stages in the production of corn ethanol, but just focusing for a moment on the actual processing of corn into ethanol. In the past, it had been processed with natural gas, which, of course, is a fossil fuel, but is cleaner than some. Now, natural gas prices are high, and coal seems to be the new direction that ethanol plants are being fueled by, which is really alarming because coal is one of the dirtiest forms of energy that there is. So in the case of Archer Daniels Midland, they have proposed one plant in Columbus, Nebraska, and they're building another, which is coal-fired, and the energy is going to be used to produce ethanol. There are many other factors in the creation of ethanol, too, in terms of the growing of the corn, and we can get into that. But in the case of the processing, it's a really alarming issue because there are about 190 new plants that are slated for ethanol production. And some experts estimate that maybe the vast majority of them may be built for coal fire energy production, which would negate any, you know, putting aside any controversies about how much energy corn ethanol makes, given that coal is so filthy a form of energy, there's, you know, it would eclipse any gains and then some.
And then besides greenhouse emissions, you mentioned other consequences of having a corn-derived energy source. And one of those that you mentioned was fertilizer and nitrogen runoff. Could you explain the environmental consequences of this?
Sure. Well, as the writer Michael Pollan has written about fairly extensively, corn is a very damaging crop when it's grown in a conventional way, which it tends to be, and certainly for ethanol. Corn is grown in vast fields in the Midwest primarily, and corn is one of the most herbicide intensive crops that there is. Atrazine is one of the main herbicides that's used on corn, and atrazine is a chemical that is has been banned by the European Union, but is the most extensively used herbicide in the U.S., primarily on corn, although also on people's lawns. And it's the pesticide, the second most likely pesticide to be found in the groundwater. So people are drinking this stuff. It's getting into rivers and streams. The runoff, though, and that's just one herbicide that's used. Nitrogen fertilizer, as you mentioned, are used very intensively on corn. And in the Midwest, you have the problem of fertilizer running off into the Mississippi River. And then in the Gulf of Mexico, there is this essentially dead zone, this very large area of the Gulf of Mexico where the nitrogen fertilizer has killed the algae. And as the algae decomposes, it uses up the oxygen that marine life needs to survive. So the EPA is attempting in some way to address this, but really the issue is one of the origin of all of it, which is the intense use of pesticides and herbicides and nitrogen fertilizer on crops like corn.
Are there any other environmental consequences to using ethanol?
Well, again, about corn, another issue is the draining of wetlands. And then really, if the U.S. were to replace petroleum at the levels that it uses now with corn, there's really a question of how much land would be necessary to do that. Estimates go from all the cropland right now that is used for food production would have to be turned to corn production to five times that amount. So that would be a real issue for people who are concerned about the environment.
And that actually plays into my next question a bit, which is relating to oil dependency. You know, environmental questions aside, people say that, well, perhaps ethanol would pave the way for us having a more secure energy source and locally grown renewable energy source. What is your response to this?
Well, that's interesting because the Bush administration has been pushing ethanol recently, and because they're wary of acknowledging that global warming is an issue, they've been framing it as a question of oil dependency, and that, you know, that we need ethanol not because global warming is a real danger, but because we want to be less dependent on foreign oil. And of course, the key word here is foreign because U.S. oil is just fine. But in terms of whether this would actually provide a legitimate alternative to petroleum, you would have to produce a vast amount of corn ethanol, as you know, I was just alluding to make anything like the levels of petroleum that we have now. I mean, the real question is, if people wanted to be less dependent on foreign oil or domestic oil, any sort of petroleum conservation and issues like that would make, I think, a whole lot more sense.
And this entire industry is heavily subsidized by the United States. And you also point out in your article that Archer Daniels Midland is also a large campaign contributor to both parties. What do you think are the consequences of this relationship? And how do you think that this is giving U.S. taxpayers a bad deal?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Archer Daniels Midland has had a very close relationship with, I would say, ruling elites from the Nixon era and earlier. But in the late 70s, under Jimmy Carter, when there was the oil crisis, Archer Daniels Midland, their CEO, Duane Andreas, made an arrangement with Jimmy Carter to promote ethanol as an alternative to foreign oil. And at the time, the government instituted two things which have benefited ADM enormously. One is the U.S. government put up at the time a tariff on foreign ethanol, in particular ethanol that's coming from Brazil, which is the largest producer of ethanol outside the U.S., has a very extensive industry of sugarcane ethanol. And it's much cheaper than the ethanol that is produced by ADM or by producers in the United States. But at this point, for every gallon of Brazilian ethanol that gets imported into the U.S., it gets slapped with a 54-cent tariff. So it makes it, all of a sudden, it makes it not competitive. And yet, as I said, it's cheaper than U.S. ethanol. So in a way, you know, that's one essential subsidy to American ethanol producers like ADM. The other thing is there is a tax credit that ethanol producers in this country get, which also dates back to that time, to 1980, where for every gallon of ethanol that is produced in this country, there is a tax credit of 51 cents. So that's adds up. And actually, the Government Accounting Office estimates that subsidies to the ethanol industry from 1980 to 2000 total $11 billion. And since ADM is the largest, has been during that time, the largest ethanol producer, it has gotten the vast share of that. And actually, Congress is currently considering several bills to extend the 51-cent per gallon tax credit beyond its expiration in 2010. And if it does that, it is estimated that it would cost taxpayers $5 billion if they extend it to beyond 2010, and more than $15 billion in 2020. So all of us are subsidizing ADM, and yet it's a Fortune 500 company. It's the 56th largest company in the United States, and even in just the last quarter, its profits went up 30%. I think its profits for the past year were $1 billion. So this is not a company that, you know, is struggling. It's doing very well.
Okay, and to focus on, you know, Archer Daniels Midland for a second, aside from the ethanol issue, there is also a bar about what they're investing in other countries, you know, being the destruction of rainforests indirectly and human rights abuses in Africa. Could you make a few comments on that?
Sure. Well, as an agribusiness giant, it operates not just in the United States, but around the world. And it's because the company is a processor of grains and foodstuffs, it buys say grains from farmers, a lot of times financing it and then processes it and sells it. So in the case of Brazil, there in the Amazon rainforest, people are clearing large swaths of the Amazon for soy production. And Greenpeace International claims that Archer Daniels Midland, along with two other agribusiness giants, is financing these farmers and then financing the shipping of soy out of the Amazon. ADM has four grain silos in the Amazon for sending this soy out. And it's heading to the European Union where people are, where it goes to feed grain. And it's kind of ironic because in Europe, people are concerned about mad cow disease and the feeding of cattle bones and body parts to other cattle. So they think that this is a healthy alternative, soy from ADM, but in fact, it's actually contributing to global warming by cutting down the Amazon.
Okay, so something that all of these, you know, issues brings up is, what is a truly green fuel? What alternatives are there for people that do realize that our current energy use is unsustainable and want some sort of solution to that problem?
Well, I think that's a complicated question because there's no easy answer. I think one of the pitfalls of ethanol, actually, is that people think that by substituting corn-based ethanol for gasoline, they're just sort of solving the question of global warming right there. And we don't, you know, we can keep driving these big SUVs, you know, as long as they're fueled with corn ethanol. And I think that's really simplistic. I don't think there are any easy answers. Possibly cellulosic ethanol made from grasses might be a better option. But it also depends on how it's processed. Do they use coal? And then the questions of scale, too, and because you're still taking ecosystems and transforming them into fields of grass. So there's a question there about that, but maybe that's a possibility. One of the things that I think is striking is that people seem to think that the options are simply between corn ethanol or keeping using petroleum, and that, in fact, the interests of the petroleum industry are not the interests of the ethanol industry. Like, the two are kind of locked in mortal combat, and that's just not true. In fact, the oil industry has been getting into ethanol production itself, and in fact, the latest CEO of ADM comes from Chevron, Patricia Wirtz. She just left Chevron to come to ADM. So the interests of the oil industry and ethanol industry are not separate. And in fact, I think in a way it sort of takes the heat off the oil industry when people think that, well, okay, now my gasoline is being mixed with ethanol. But I think what is getting lost in all of this is questions about how do we structure our cities? How do we structure our lives and become less dependent on cars in general to cut our energy consumption? And by replacing one fuel with another, that's not addressing that dimension of things. Not that conservation will answer all of our problems, but that is really missing in these debates.
You have been listening to CorpWatch Radio, brought to you by CorpWatch.org. Special thanks to David Morley and Lisa Zhu for research assistance, Brooke Biggs for editorial support, and Liam O'Donohue for anchoring. Also thanks to Odeo, Pacifica, and Indie Media for distribution assistance. You have heard music by the Art Ensemble of Chicago and The Nothing. I'm your host, Sakura Saunders. Thanks for listening.